Yeah, and we have to have peace in St. Louis, in these United States. So, yes, this is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. And we are in the midst of election season, so we got to know what's going on, who's doing what, so that we can go to the ballot box an informed woke voter. So this is the show that connects the folks who are on the battlefield. They are fighting for democracy, justice. They are fighting for all the things that we need to be fighting for. But we are here at Harrisville State University live. And we have to say that all the comments on this show are not necessarily those of Harrisville State University or Black Radio Hall of Fame, but we got to say what we got to say, y'all. So, yeah, so let's first of all, let me just say this, y'all. This is like a public service announcement. Thank you for all of your concerns. Percy Green is alive and well. His email was hacked yesterday, as well as his son. So please do not give to anybody that's saying Percy just got out of the hospital. Okay? So I'm going to say two things, y'all. And our special guest is Mayor Jones. And Mayor Jones does not know I'm going to say this, but I feel like I have to just because of the way things have been evolving around this election season. So the two things are, one, we're going to make sure we understand what the role and responsibilities of the mayor's office is so that when we get ready to hold people accountable, we're holding them for the right stuff, okay? So, we heard a lot about the snow removal, did we not? And I'm going to tell y'all, yes, there were issues with the snow removal. We have a community center right on the corner of Rowan and Ridge. Been there for now over 50 years. I'm going to tell y'all, I have never, I must repeat that again, never seen a snowplow on Ridge, okay? So that was like, what, 3-4 mayors there? And I never heard a peep from folks. And I have to say, I didn't complain because there were other more important things for me to be complaining and organizing around. I thought somebody else would pick that up. So the fact that all of a sudden we're concerned about snow removal for this particular mayor, I think is really unfair. That's the first thing. The second thing is I do want to explain a little bit about city government since I had the pleasure, the opportunity, the privilege of serving under three mayors, so I know a little bit about how this stuff works. So, and this just came up the other day at a ward meeting. When a new mayor is selected, there is a regime change. They get to choose their cabinet appointees, folks that they know and trust. But there's all these other folks there that are part of the bureaucracy that are serving the city of St. Louis. What I know from my lived experiences is that those people fall in two categories. One is they are going to do their job no matter who is the mayor. I know people in Slate that have been there 30 years. They were there when I was there. They're going to do their job no matter who's the mayor because that's what they're committed to. Now, there's another sector of people who are there causing mischief. They are saboteurs. Sometimes they're left over from the previous administration. And sometimes they feel like they have to be an obstacle in the progress of the new person. You all should know that. So when you think about holding somebody accountable, there's all these moving parts inside city government. There's multiple agencies, and there's multiple personalities and people. So having done that little bit of historical background, we are going to welcome Mayor Tashara Jones to Voices from the Battlefield. How you doing, Mayor?
I am well. Hello. How are you?
I am well, too. I am excited about the upcoming election. But I really did a bit of a changing in the questions that I wanted to ask, because I know you've been on the road and answering the very specific questions about issues and problems. And I really want people to understand the systems part of it. So, for example, and this is the same question I asked of Michael Butler last week, is what is the role of the recorder of deeds? I mean, because people don't know what the functions are of these various agencies and departments. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, so this last couple of years, I've just been doing civics lessons.
Right.
Here's what this, because I told him, we don't want people coming to your office asking for a police report. That's not what you do.
Right.
So, and sometimes people ask of you things that are out of your jurisdiction. And so what exactly is the mayor's office responsible for?
Well, again, thank you for having me, Mama Jamala. I'm sorry, I don't know any other name to call you. The responsibility of the mayor, many may say that we have a weak mayor system. And I often say the position is only as weak as the person that's in it. But the mayor cannot make any spending decisions or enter into any contracts without the vote of the Board of Estimate and Apportionment, which is chaired by myself and is consists of the comptroller and as well as the president of the Board of Aldermen. And so every month we meet to approve contracts, to approve changes to tables of organization, either deleting or adding new positions, as well as transfers between different department funds. Then the mayor's office isn't over all of the city departments. There are specific city departments that the mayor is responsible for. I have a cabinet and staff, and that can be located on my website. But just for your listeners' edification, that's streets, traffic, and refuse. It's forestry, parks, and recreation. It's the city councilor, the Board of Public Service, which is all of our infrastructure projects. It's the Department of Public Safety. And under the Department of Public Safety is the police chief, the fire chief, the building division, the neighborhood stabilization officers, as well as Division of Corrections. And there are, you know, several other departments that I just can't think of right now, but it is a big job. And I would say most of the city departments fall under that structure. However, we need to remember that we have 9 citywide elected officials, with the mayor being one of them. We have 6 countywide officials, which I have, you know, that are independently elected. The sheriff, the recorder of deeds, the license collector, the collector of revenue, the treasurer, and the circuit attorney.
And I think that's important. I think that's important for you to say, because most people see them as city agencies that you have some control over. And this notion of being sort of quasi city county, I think it still doesn't reconcile in people's head. Like, they're sitting up here and some of the budget goes to them, so why aren't they a city government? And so I think that does go back to the charter, correct?
It goes back to the charter, and it goes back to the Great Divorce, when St. Louis City divorced from St. Louis County way back in the 1700s or 1800s? And so we are our own city and our own county. So I like to say that I'm the mayor, but I have 8 vice mayors. Who have their own individual
vice mayors.
Who have their own individual responsibilities. And because I was treasurer before becoming mayor, I saw the importance of making sure that we connect with our countywide elected officials. And so we have monthly meetings to see what they're working on, to see how my administration can help, and to see, you know, how we can work together to move our city forward, whether that's resources, software, you know, how our departments can talk to each other. So we have been doing that for four straight years.
Okay. So I'm thinking about, for example, the recorder of deeds. I mean, that's a place where they've made considerable progress in terms of the technology and connecting. So are they also connected with the county's recorder of deeds? So if you got something there, if the boundaries are so artificial.
Right.
Not just here, but in this country, in the world, they're artificial. So if somebody has a business here in St. Louis, but they live in the county, are they going to have to go to two separate offices to figure out what they need?
So you said they have a business in St. Louis,
but they live in the county.
Yes. So whatever their business entity, then that information comes to City Hall. But if they live in the county, then they, you know, every other function that they need is in county government.
Okay.
Related to their residence.
So we have talked a long time about the need for city charter changes.
Yes.
And I was one of the main ones helping to rally people around the need for that. I don't think the process came down the way people thought it would. I think personally it was too short. There needed to have been like a citywide deal for 2 years before we even get to recommendations, so that people really truly understood what you just said. We got county offices right here in the city. We got city offices. What are the main things that need to be changed? And I know this just from an organizer who's trying to make change, and then you bump up against something and say, okay, you all can't do that because that's in the charter. We're like, what?
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense. It's like, okay, the charter is like, you know, how many hundreds of years old? So I was a believer that it needed to be changed. You talked just a minute ago about the weak mayor system. And I know, I believe what you said is that whoever's in there is who makes it strong, because Kansas City has a different kind of mayor.
Right.
And they complain.
Exactly.
So we don't have the perfect thing yet, and I think we're struggling to make whatever structure we have in place work for the vast majority of the people. There's some changes that people are trying to bring about, and I know the county has one where it's a lawsuit. Can you explain about that? Because I think for me, it's all a part of this whole thing of taking back, you know, so anything that's got a Democratic brand on it, you know, the Democratic mayor, county exec, governor, pretty much are targets now.
Mm-hmm.
So is this a part of it, this whole thing of like they want an amendment to appear so that it's going to weaken the power of the executive, county executive there? What is that about? Because I'm understanding that it could come to St. Louis in terms of that being a challenge.
Right. So in St. Louis County at the moment, they are, they put a measure on the ballot. The county council put a measure on the ballot to allow the county council to remove any of the county executive's department heads from office. And that weakens the authority of the county executive. You elect a county executive to do specific functions, same thing as you elect a mayor to do specific functions. And the council is supposed to be the legislative body, not an executive body. And I think that this is a little bit of overreach into the executive branch. Same thing is happening in St. Louis at the moment. An alderwoman has introduced a charter change to create a city manager. And we already have a city manager and the director of operations. But I personally feel like they don't like her. So this is why they're introducing this bill. Same thing in St. Louis County. They've had problems with some of Sam Page's appointees. And so instead of trying to work together to come to a consensus, this is the direction that they're taking. But in a typical city manager form of government, which Kansas City currently has, that city manager is over some key functions in order to make city government work. This particular bill that has been proposed by in St. Louis doesn't touch any of those departments. A city manager is supposed to be over HR, supposed to be over finance, in a true city management form of government. But as I said earlier, we have eight competing vice mayors, and we have three quote, vice mayors that control different parts of finance. We have one that collects the revenue. We have one that invests the revenue. And we have another one that pays the bills. So, and if this city manager is not over that, and then personnel doesn't report to the mayor at all, they report to the Civil Service Commission, which is a 3-member board appointed by the mayor. If this city manager doesn't control those two key functions, they're powerless.
So this, again, this is part of the civics lessons that we need to have, because I think when people read about that stuff or even hear it in 30-second sound bites, they still glaze over. Like, what? Huh? What? And in some cases, to be honest, it sounds like it could be a good idea until you know the context in which it's coming. Then you say, oh, okay,
right,
that person is doing it. And it's about this person. So to me, the way that city government is starting to devolve, and I don't want to blame it all on the MAGA people, but I think when you have an environment, a political environment, where people are jockeying for power, for position, a lot of the stuff gets lost in terms of what is your mission. What's the mission of this office? What are you supposed to be doing? Mm-hmm. And it's all about what more can I get? What more power can I get? So, you know, for us, because there was something on the ballot last November, I think it was consolidating the streets and transportation.
Yeah, there was no consolidation. It was just changing the name.
But people didn't understand that.
Right.
And I said, if you don't understand it, just vote no, because somebody's responsibility was to let us know exactly what that meant so that we would be fully informed. Mm-hmm. So I get it, but if it's just a name change, that's not exactly what the ballot language said.
Right.
And so it sounded like there was some power grabbing and people were trying to get more up under this. It just makes people then back off of, like, being more involved.
Right, exactly. And my biggest concern with that piece of legislation to change streets to the Department of Transportation was that there was no money that came with it. Currently, and let's talk about potholes for a second, because that's what everybody's talking about in this race. Currently, all 14 aldermen have a pot of ward capital or ward money that gets allocated to them every year. And they are responsible for spending that money in their wards on the things that matter to their constituents. That money should go to repave streets in the ward, to fix sidewalks through the 50-50 sidewalk program. That money can go to replace trash bins and other economic development projects if they so choose. There are some alders who have upwards of $2 million still sitting in their ward capital funds and have not used it to repave streets in their wards, yet complain about potholes. If we repave the streets on a regular basis, then we wouldn't have potholes. Or if the streets department or Department of Transportation or whatever you call it had a pot of funds that they knew they were going to get every year to repave the roads, then we wouldn't have potholes. But that's not currently the case. So to your listeners, everybody who's complaining about potholes, call your alderman. Your alderman is sitting on money. Some spend it, and some do spend it on repaving streets. I'm not talking about all of them, but there are some who have not spent their war capital on repaving streets, and then they talk about potholes.
So I'm just going to do a follow-up, because one of the things that you came into this office with is more transparency. Where would constituents find that particular pot of money for their ward so that they can speak very intelligently when they get ready to go to their alderperson and says, you got X number of dollars, and why hasn't that ever come to the ward meeting so that we could help you help us?
Well, I would love to put that information online. However, I've been told I shouldn't.
Why not? It's taxpayer money.
It's taxpayer money. It's taxpayer money. But they can call the Board of Public Service and they can ask them, how much money does my alder have in their ward capital fund?
So to me, again, that's troubling that we don't have that information at hand, because I think it would go a lot towards people feeling invested.
Holding people accountable.
Hold them accountable, mm-hmm. But also the rest of us feeling like we've been part of investing in our own neighborhoods where we live and work and play.
Right.
Yeah, that's something's got to be done about that. So I'm just remembering the notion about money and this whole ARPA money, and where mm-hmm. are we with the ARPA money? Are we spent out? Is it, what's the word that when you haven't spent it, but it's allocated?
Obligated.
Obligated.
Obligated is the word that the Treasury Department gives us to use. So 100% of ARPA funds have been obligated. That means that there are contracts that are in place that are signed, and we will be spending that money over the next 2 years. We have until 2026 to spend the money. And no city in this country has spent 100% of their ARPA funds. Let me repeat. No city in this country, no large city in this country, has spent 100% of their ARPA funds. Not even the state. The state got their own allocation of ARPA funds. They haven't spent 100% of their funds. Everybody has obligated 100% of their ARPA funds by the December 31st, 2024 deadline. But we still have 2 more years to spend the money.
Okay, so then the question might come up for people like, as bad as situations are, why hasn't that money been spent? Because surely there was some shovel-ready projects that could be funded.
There are. That most of it has been spent. I will say that. A good chunk, of, I would say maybe 50% or more has been spent. There is a transparency portal that is up on the city's website, or they can go to strongerstl.org or .com. I can't remember which one. And they can see what we spent it on and how much is left to be spent. Now, there may be a delay because we rely on the comptroller's office to update it as they send the money out. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, obviously. So what is it looking like now? Because one of your commitments was to make sure that North City got what they needed. Mm-hmm. We have heard that a lot. Again, I'm reminding people I was under three mayors where tons of money came through with the empowerment zone. I mean, so many different programs, and it was always about what we're going to do for North City. North City looks worse now than it did, you know, 20 years ago. So was there a particular plan, or are we doling out to individual businesses and agencies to make sure that they're going to be part of an ecosystem that helps grow it? Or was there a plan from the get-go to say, okay, we're going to concentrate on these, you know, 17 blocks, and we're going to focus some money and some training and some support for these folks? How was that determined?
I would say all of the above. We do have a plan. It's called the Economic Justice Action Plan. That's up on SLDC's website. Has 3 pillars. We will to empower, develop, and transform areas that haven't been invested in decades, primarily North St. Louis and parts of Southeast St. Louis. That plan is already in motion. We've been able to leverage $250 million into $1 billion of investment all across the city, but in particular in North St. Louis. And people can go to our website to look at the grants and impact map, and you can drill down by ward or by neighborhood to see how ARPA funds and Prop NS funds and other CDBG funds have been spent in your neighborhood and in your ward. With building houses, with grants, with any program that we have administered. And if people look at that map, you know how sometimes when you look at a map of St. Louis and all of the bad things are like in North St. Louis and that part of South St. Mm-hmm. Louis? Well, that's what it looks like, but all of our investment is in those areas. So we've been able to build homes and generate mortgages in neighborhoods that haven't seen mortgage generation in 15 or 20 years. We purchased the old Killark electrical plant on Martin Luther King and Vandeventer, mm-hmm. and turning that into
exactly where that is.
Mm-hmm. That's going to become the Monarch, which is going to be a center for economic mobility. Workforce development is going to go there. Our Office of Violence Prevention, our Economic Empowerment Center, the Land Reutilization Authority, as well as a couple of businesses that we have recruited to build in North St. Louis. We're also trying to build adjacent to that facility, a childcare facility, realizing that, you know, people are going to need childcare as they interact with these services.
And is that going to be city operated?
No, okay, we're going to
contract it out.
Yeah,
and I'm noting as I'm looking at the geography that that's really a neighbor of Rankin Institute. Or is there going to be some relationship, collaboration? Yes,
absolutely. And then also adjacent to Rankin is AMIC, which is the Advanced Manufacturing Innovation Center. We received a $25 million grant from the Biden-Harris administration for that in conjunction with Boeing. Those two facilities are also going to connect to NGA, which will all be connected by the Green Line, which is the new public transit line that we're trying to build for north to go north and south on Jefferson. So all of these projects are in the making, right? And you'll start to see them physically in my next term, should I be reelected. You'll also see free Wi-Fi up and down Martin Luther King from, I want to say, all the way to the city limits. I think it's Grand all the way to the city limits. So we are hard at work. And also free Wi-Fi in 9 other city parks, Ivory Perry being one of them.
Okay.
And that signal is strong because the recent snowstorm that we had that knocked out power and Wi-Fi in my neighborhood, I came home and my TV was working, and I didn't know how my son was able to connect the TV to the Wi-Fi in the park. That's a strong signal.
Yeah.
And we're trying to expand to more parks. We've done some renovations in Fairground Park, new basketball courts, new pickleball courts and resurfaced tennis courts. We fixed the Fairground Park pool from the vandalism that happened a couple of years ago. We've been hard at work. And also we're repaving our major north-south thoroughfares. So Kings Highway, we started that work until winter came. Well, as soon as spring springs, we'll be able to continue that work. And also traffic calming. So we can slow down the traffic on Kings Highway, Union, Goodfellow, Grand, and Jefferson.
Okay. So you mentioned the Greenway and then the Metrolink. And when people heard that you were going to be on the show, there were a couple of folks who are in the Jeff Van Loo area that have, raised concerns about what's coming through there and the cost efficiency of it and the environmental impact and all of that. What input was had by the community folks around what that could look like? I'm reminded of that the amount of space that went from that UCity trolley that disrupted and put some companies out of business there in the loop. And it took a while to get that thing up and running, and then people didn't even use it. And so
we're using it now.
Yeah, barely, because I'm keeping my eye on it.
We got a letter from the Department of Transportation that said, you better get this thing running or you won't get any more grants.
Exactly. But it's still, I don't know if people are not using it out of protest or it's just
no,
not.
No, people are using it. We had our highest ridership just this past season.
Oh, okay, because I'll keep my eye on it. And I'm up and down that area frequently, and I don't see it moving.
It only runs in the summer.
Oh, in the summer.
Yes. The people who originally built the loop trolley did not build tracks for winter operations.
Duh. Okay, so there we have it.
And the trolleys don't have air or heat. So
there we have it, y'all. So when y'all think about...
And I had to clean all that up.
Yeah. Because I remember when it was going dark and folks was like, it needs to be shuttered. I'm like, wait a minute, all that money that went into that thing, and some of it was city tax dollars, something needs to happen. So it's only seasonal.
It's seasonal. And April to October.
Okay. So I think those are the kind of things when people look at who gets to have these special projects and how much money it costs, even when they aren't as successful or effective as they should be. And then somebody, as you say, has to come and kind of clean it up. Those are the unseen, untold stories, really, because, I know a lot about that project, thanks to the people who live in UCity who provided me with the information. But I do know there were a number of businesses along the loop that just couldn't survive.
Right, because of the construction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So again, what the thought process is for, doing these projects. And what's the major concern of people over there with the Metrolink coming over there?
I would say that of all of the neighborhoods that are against Well, there are only two neighborhoods that are concerned about the Metrolink Green Line or the North-South Green Line, and that's JBL and Lafayette Square. And one of those neighborhoods, and I won't name which one, is opposed to it because they don't want black people in their neighborhood. You can figure out which one. But we are doing all of the environmental studies, but this the outreach has been going on for the last year or two, and they've been studying this for the last 10, at least 5 to 7 years, because I remember as treasurer giving money to the Slay administration to start the study for the Metrolink Green Line. The current path, which goes up and down Jefferson, is going to be in the middle of the street, not on the sides. So that has less of an opportunity to rattle people's homes. And the technology that we're using will not rattle people's homes. And for those who say we should do bus rapid transit instead, the citizens of St. Louis passed a tax specifically for Metrolink expansion. So we can't use it for anything else but Metrolink expansion without going back to a vote of the people.
Well, there's some thinking that, you know, that part of it, particularly where it's going, is going to be mainly for the folks at the NGA to come and go. So what's the response to that? Because, I mean, when you think about what's over there, I'm talking about coming down Jefferson, right, is not a whole lot.
Right. And it's been proven that projects like that spur economic development. And so we have also made the changes to our zoning laws to be able to build the density around the area so we can build up that area because it hasn't seen investment in decades. So, you know, the route isn't as long as we would like it to be, obviously, and we were working with St. Louis County to try to connect it to St. Louis County and go all the way out to West Florissant and 270. But there is a part of the route that we just can't afford to build. So we had two choices: don't build it at all or go forward with what we have. And so what we have is a route that starts at Fairground Park at Grand and Natural Bridge, goes all the way down Natural Bridge and makes a right turn on Jefferson, mm-hmm, which is, I think, is Parnell at that point.
Yeah.
And then goes all the way down Jefferson to Chippewa, I believe. So that connects people, and it will connect to the red and blue lines, okay, at Ewing, I believe, you know, right where around 40 and 44, right where that meets, mm-hmm, or 40. So there will be connection to the other lines, and 20% of the people that live along that line don't have access to a car.
Right, right. If you are just joining us, this is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield, and we are here with the mayor of the city of St. Louis, Tashara Jones. She is the incumbent. There are three people who are also running. Last week we had Mike Butler on the show. The other two candidates did not respond to the invitation, which is fine. All you can do is invite people. So it was a good conversation with Mike Butler, and you got a chance to hear his life story and what he's doing in that office and what he hopes to do in the mayor's office. So let's talk about, because one of the things I think, you know, I've been concerned about, and that is citizen participation. So when we saw the election 3 years ago, almost 4 years ago, and we saw the changes that were happening, so we were going to have a progressive mayor, progressive president of the board of alders, and then we have progressive controller. And we're like, wow, we getting ready to, like, see some leaps and bounds and some progress here, which we had not seen because people are just holding on to the status quo, holding on to their little piece of the pie. And so we said, let's get this thing rolling. That hasn't happened in the way that I thought it could and should. But one of the more double down things is there are citizen committees, citizen task force, citizen commissions, and some of those have been problematic. You had the Detention Facilities Oversight Board, which, mm-hmm, ran into a lot of problems with trying to get into the city jail. People are wondering what's happening with the Reparations Commission. So when we are encouraging, and I say we, I'm saying the movement community, say we need to get in there and help the folks that we got elected. Mm-hmm. And so we could be the ears and eyes, and we could help some of this stuff move. But then there's all these obstacles that get put in the way. So what, you know, and I know that people are saying what took so long for us to realize that the person that was heading up CJC, the Justice Center, was not the best person for that. Explain a little bit about the thinking around, okay, what this person's there, there's deaths that are happening, people are trying to get in to see what's happening, but we just can't make it work.
So let's start with the Detention Facilities Oversight Board, which was a piece of legislation that I supported. And actually, we wanted to make sure that we were putting it under a division of civilian oversight. So we have the Civilian Oversight Board and the Detention Facilities Oversight Board, all under the Division of Civilian Oversight, which reports to the Department of Public Safety.
And I want to interrupt right there, because that was movement people helping to shape that legislation.
Yes.
So it didn't come out of the blue. We felt like there needed to be an oversight that dealt with both of those oversight committees. It just made sense. Do you need somebody over the whole thing? Okay, go
right,
ahead.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. And the any vendor or any provider of services has to go through a level of training before they are allowed access into the facility. And some DFOB, the Detention Facilities Oversight Board, refused to participate in the training, and then showed up in the jail requesting access. That's not how this works. And then we scheduled training after training after training to try to get everybody trained, to try to have a sort of a group field trip, for lack of a better term, to the CJC so they could learn more about what's going on in the facility. Also, a question is making sure that the detainees themselves have spoken with their attorneys and provided the correct waivers in order to speak to our DFOB members or their investigators. There were issues trying to get the proper sign-offs there as well. And then we also ended up changing leadership at the helm of the Division of Civilian Oversight. Hindsight being 2020, it was more chaotic than it should have been. And we should have had stronger leadership there to shepherd people through this new process. And there was a lot of confusion. However, I think we're at a good point. Now we have stable leadership there. The investigators are getting what they need. The oversight board is also getting the training that they need. I think some have already had access into the facility. And also we are making direct changes in the jail that are going to make it, I hate to say this, a better place for people who are serving and waiting for trial. We're bringing in a new commissioner, and he has given me a list of things that he wants to do in the first 120 days, and he's already off to a good start. And then the health services were not optimal as well. So we got a new health provider at the end of 23, and also put our Department of Health over that health provider as a supervisor. And as a result, in 23, we had 5 deaths, still too many. And last year we had 2. So we're making great progress on the health care that we provide to our detainees while they are in our care. I think on the flip side, we also have to look at how long our detainees are there. This is not supposed to be a long-term stay for them, and some are there upwards of 5 years. Mm-hmm. So what we're doing is working through our Criminal Justice Coordinating Committee, which consists of all of our public safety department, as well as judges, circuit attorney's office, to see how we can create some sort of rocket docket for those who've been there longer than 5 years.
Yeah, because, you know, that defies the whole constitutional question of, you know, speedy trials.
Exactly.
But it does, I think about, you know, people are now reliving the situation where the young athlete was, you know, lost her legs in an accident. And I remember when it first happened, and Kim Gardner was the circuit attorney, and the media somehow turned it around to her office. And we had to explain to people getting out on bond and whether they wear an ankle bracelet, that is under the judges. And so it reminds me of the situation in the city jail. Okay, why are people there so long? I mean, that is a judicial issue. That's not an executive branch issue. And right. So I'm glad to hear that you all are working with that, because if I happen to be picked up because of warrants of unpaid tickets, you mean to tell me I might be in there for 2 years? I mean, really, yeah. It gets to be ridiculous, because, first of all, it is a monetary issue with me staying there and having to pay for my food and blah, 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 blah. But now I'm losing money, lost my job. I mean, it's just, some of it just seems to be easily correctable from other people's eyesight. But then it's these bureaucracies, and then you talking about bringing in all these various agencies that they have to work together. They're under regulations. They're under laws. Mm-hmm. When do you think we could see some real changes in those stays decreasing over time?
Well, I think that's a question for our judicial system, as well as our circuit attorneys. You know, our circuit attorney, we just got a new one, Gabe Gore, who was reelected. Mm-hmm. He is trying to staff up the circuit attorney's office. He was woefully understaffed when he began. And is almost at full staffing level. But still, he also deals with, you know, those positions don't pay a lot. Mm-hmm. And so you have those who want to be there, and you have those who come and, you know, stay for about 12 to 18 months in order to get their bona fides, you know, mm-hmm. get their feet wet and, you know.
And bump up their resumes.
Right, mm-hmm. right. And then go on to private practice, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Whereas we saw Gabe go from private practice to doing this, mm-hmm. Which is a labor of love. I think that, you know, folks can only move as fast as the rest of the justice system allows. Mm-hmm. So there's a huge backlog that Gabe and his office are still working on. Hopefully, you know, again, through our work with the Criminal Justice Coordinating Committee, we can prioritize some of the ones who've been there for a really long time.
Yeah. The other Citizens Commission was around reparations. And I know I've had people not just from the commission here, but from other commissions, from Kansas City Commission, from other commissions, talking about what they're doing in their respective cities, because that was a real bump from the Black Mayors Conference when folks raised their hand and said, we're going to do that in our city, and you and the mayor in Kansas City,
Lucas
mm-hmm. said, yes, we're going to do that. So we were just, I really was bringing them together to kind of see what folks are doing where they are, because it's going to look quite different based mm-hmm. on the circumstances and situations and the history of racism. Mm-hmm. So it's just been illuminating, and this is the first time where I think we've had a serious conversation
right.
about reparations. So there were recommendations made by that commission. I think they have sunset it now. Mm-hmm. But what's going to be, who carries the ball now?
I think it's on us. It's on us. I attended a couple of meetings, and from the input that I got from the commission, as well as reading through the report, I realized that a lot of the things that were raised in the report that we're already working on. Our Economic Justice Action Plan is investing in areas that haven't seen investment in decades. And that was part of the report, the economic development part, and investing in communities. Unfortunately, the state of Missouri prohibits us from making direct cash payments. So that may not be possible for us unless the Constitution changes. But a lot of the healthcare, we need to work with our healthcare providers to make sure that we are that reparations comes in that form as well. But I think that because I have been so intentional about investing in Black and brown communities, in particular Black communities, and making sure that we are lifting their boats in the tide, which in turn lifts our entire city. I think that, you know, we are definitely addressing many parts of the report.
Okay. And then something else around the reparations. Oh, when you said there's some prohibitions about what you can do in terms of cash payments, I think we still can look at creative ways that that can happen.
If we can find a private funder.
Well, even mm-hmm. what if we say that there is some kind of...
it has to be in exchange for a service.
Yeah. Let's think about that. Because I was just thinking about, like, can you get a reduction on your real estate taxes? Or can you get your driver's license fee waived? You know, mm-hmm. I mean, those...
That's a state thing, the driver's license fees.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. See, I can maintain those jurisdictions.
Right, right. Property and real estate taxes is something that we can work with because we've done the... Well, no, that's also state, you know, the state passed the senior property tax freeze, and then we were required to pass complementary legislation or enabling legislation on the local level. So we did that, but that was specifically for seniors. Mm-hmm. So any changes in real estate tax collection also has to come from the state.
Yeah. I'm going to think on that one because I think I'm not a big fan of... Well, I think you can do both. I think there could be cash payments and some systemic stuff, but all of that, the cash stuff doesn't have to come from the city. That needs to be federal dollars. But right. I'd also want to talk a little bit about the school system, because I think that's another thing that people confuse, that maybe the mayor appoints the superintendent and therefore the mayor has some control about what's going on in the school system. And, of course, that's not true. That doesn't mean you don't have a relationship with the school district, because mm-hmm. obviously the kids that go there are
the same kids that are roaming around the city.
Exactly. Yes. And their parents mm-hmm. are voters. And, you know, mm-hmm. so there is a relationship there. But I think sometimes the governance piece gets confused about what more you could do.
Right.
But what I think the city can have more input in is these abandoned school buildings. I'm really, like, in the ward that I've been in for 50 years, mm-hmm. we used to have 6 schools. Now we have one. That's Pierre Laclede. All the rest of them are abandoned, mm-hmm. you know, with shades flapping out of them. Okay, so whose responsibility is that for upkeep? And a reminder that, you know, you all have a stabilization program where you are trying to create mm-hmm. viable communities. But if you have a school that's basically abandoned, has been, halfway demolished, you know, Hempstead is sitting over there, a lightning bolt.
That was such a
beautiful school.
Oh, my God.
Lightning yes. struck it, so half the roof is caved gone. In. Mm-hmm. So, okay, it's really now a safety hazard. So should we be, like, pressuring the school board to, like, do something about these buildings? And I know that, for example, the schools in North St. Louis are not looked at as real estate like the ones in South St. Louis, because I've seen them do some nice things with some of the schools. They turned them into lofts and this mm-hmm. and that.
Mm-hmm.
But, okay, so it looks like these schools over on our way, nothing's going to happen to them. And some of them now don't even need they're not salvageable. So what happens to them, and what does the city have in terms of responsibility or even the resources to address that problem?
So the city is currently trying to buy 2 schools from the district, Marshall School on Martin Luther King and the old Cleveland Naval ROT, mm-hmm. Naval Junior ROTC mm-hmm. Academy. Mm-hmm. And we are in negotiations with the school board to do so. But the responsibility for the upkeep and the maintenance of those buildings is on the school board, not the city. We do have a private property stabilization program where we try to hold building owners accountable and tell them, if you're not going to fix your eyesore that you have in our neighborhoods, we will fix it for you and send you the bill. But that's usually on smaller projects that require, you know, $50,000 to $100,000 of repairs. We also have the Prop NS program that, remember, Sundi Whiteside, rest in peace, Sundi Whiteside, that she championed, that also stabilizes vacant and abandoned buildings. But that also has a limit to how much can be spent on each building. So we have those two programs, and we're currently demolishing a lot of property through an ARPA grant through our partnership with the Regional Crime Commission, which is headed by former Mayor Slay, we've demolished over 900 buildings through that partnership and with other funds that we've been able to put those funds together, because these were buildings that are far beyond being salvageable. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What are the plans for Marshall and the Academy? What do you want to do with those?
Well, first we want to take control of them and then put out an RFP for development.
Oh, okay.
So we're just waiting on the final approval from the school board for that. But the school board is responsible for selling and the upkeep and the maintenance of that. Mm-hmm. You know, and when we really talk about it, you know, about the number of children that we currently have in our schools, do we even need all of these buildings? But I don't want to get in trouble.
Well, no, I've had conversations with the former superintendent about that. I'm like, you all have paid people who forecast the number of students that are going to be when census comes and where they're going to be. And so I'm very aware that, you know, some neighborhoods, the birth rate is going down, or the people have moved to the county or whatever. So mm-hmm. the number of students that have, I think it's like around 20,000 now, I get that, but can we be more proactive about the use of the buildings before they get shut down? And right. particularly, this is what really pisses me off, Mayor, is when we put money in there to put in air conditioning, get a new gym, do, and then a year or two later, it's shut down. I mean, that, to me, is just total irresponsibility and bad judgment and a whole bunch of other things. But it seems like we have a bunch more schools that aren't used, that are used.
Or that aren't used to their full capacity. You know, for a district our size with about, you know, 15 to 20,000 students, it's the same size as Parkway, right, or Eureka. And they don't have half as many buildings as we do. We have 60-plus buildings for 20,000 students. And so what, you know, if I had a magic wand, and I'll probably get in trouble for saying this, but oh well. You know, we need to build some new schools and in all around the city. So our children also have pride in the places that they go. Now, this is, you know, no dig to some of the existing buildings that have been kept up. You know, they're beautiful buildings. You know, the architects that made some of those mm-hmm. buildings were, you know, are Hall of Fame architects, mm-hmm. right?
Itner and the rest
right,
of them.
Mm-hmm. Right. But it's... We need to consolidate. Mm-hmm. We need to have a serious discussion about consolidation and making sure that we are taking care of the kids we have, making sure that those buildings are full. And I would say with the money we save, we can pay our teachers better.
Mm. Mm. And they won't be going to Illinois or some of the other county
or
schools.
Or Clayton or yeah, Ladue. Yeah, right.
Absolutely. Right. So I'm thinking also in the time that we have left, Mayor Jones, is couple of things. One is, what are you most proud of that you've done? Because I think sometimes the amplification of what's been done gets drowned out by what hasn't been done. Right. And so what do you think are your prize accomplishments? And then from there, what do you see as some of the things you'd like to do going forward?
Mm-hmm. See, every morning when my son goes to school, you know, he's driving now.
Oh, boy.
We do our handshake and say, I love you, and then he's out the door. And as I watch him drive away, it's just the mom in me. I have to watch him drive away every day because I used to pick him up and drop him off. And as I watch him drive away, I think about the progress that we've made on crime and public safety, how in 2021 – we had 263 murders at the end of 2020, and now that's down to 150, still way too many, because families who have been touched by gun violence, any family is one too many. Mm-hmm. I have personally been touched by gun violence 4 times since I became mayor in 2021. But we've made progress on the decreased homicides. The number I'm really excited about is our youth-involved shootings have been cut in half, and we've increased our emergency response times by 60% paying more, having more 911 operators, paying them better, and we're also about to build a new 911 and emergency management center for all of our dispatchers. We're going to combine them all in one place, cross-train them, and improve our 911 response times even more. I'm proud of the creation of our Office of Violence Prevention that works with directly with community organizations on the ground, because I believe that people closest to the problem are closest to the solution. And we've been able to work with community organizations, have our kickbacks on a monthly basis and places around the city to connect people to services and meet them where they are and reduce crime even more. I'm proud of our Save Lives Now regional crime reduction initiative that's going to bring therapy into this. I'm proud of increasing our availability of behavioral health professionals. When you call 911, you can be connected to someone when you call 911, or they can visit your house through our Cops and Clinicians program, or even our non-police response. I'm proud of our investment in North St. Louis, because that's what I said I was going to do. For those who are listening, this is, well, she hasn't done enough. You know, you can't expect me to change North St. Louis, which hasn't been invested in decades, in 70 years at least. That won't change in 4 years. And we have a whole host of projects, paving projects, other investments that we have on tap. And if everything goes the way that we're planning, North St. Louis is going to look a lot different in 3 to 5 years.
Well, that'll be good news to folks, because I think the way that population has drained is because folks don't have much hope that it's going to change.
Right. And just like those decisions were intentional not to invest in North St. Louis, my decision is intentional to invest in North St. Louis, because you should have access to the same things that anybody else has access to that lives south of 40 in this town. You should have access to pharmacies. You should have access to banks and fresh grocery stores and restaurants that aren't serving you fatty fried foods, and sit-down restaurants that you can go to, and entertainment. And all of those things should be in any place in this city, and your zip code shouldn't determine your opportunity or your access to services.
And it does, unfortunately. Well, I think one of the things that I'm hoping for is that in these last, well, it's going to continue in after March, because there will be two people going forward. But I see the civility being eroded. And one of the things I definitely hate to see is when people start lying about stuff. And mm-hmm. so that makes it harder for people to cut through and find out mm-hmm. what the truth is. So my thing is, in the next, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, that we will be civil, that we will make sure that we are looking at, what the truth is. And, people will be able to know that just by the fact that they heard it from that person's mouth. Mm-hmm. and that they can rebut it when somebody else is not telling the truth. It could be an exciting time, but I'm hoping we don't turn voters off because of all the negativity. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited, and wish you the best on your campaign trail.
Thank
and I know
you.
It's going to get tougher and tougher, yeah. and more requests made of you, but good luck and be safe.
Thank you.
This is Jamala Rogers, your host, and I will see you on the battlefield.